Here we go. We are live. Thank you so much. So first of all, welcome, welcome. This is so exciting. The very first class of a new Tanya series, and Rabbi Wolf aptly named it Tanya for Daily Living 2.0, because Baruch Hashem, we stopped last week. We finished last week, very last chapter of Tanya, but nothing is stopping Jewish women from going right back to the source and saying, I want to look at this from a deeper lens. I want to go inside and see how I could understand this and better myself even more. And really, learning Tanya never ends. I know this for myself. I've gone through the Tanya a few times, but learning it with you over the last, I think it was 3 years, has been transformational. And I'm excited for us to embark on that journey again. I don't know if it will take another 3 years. Maybe we'll be able to condense it a little bit more. But the most important thing is that there is pragmatic, practical change coming from this shiur. It doesn't mean that you have to take anything upon yourself. It's much more about, do I feel like I have a wider perspective? Have I gained some knowledge about myself or Hashem? Have I in some way, somehow enhanced my life? And that's the purpose, right? The purpose is to walk away from here and move further onto something else, have impact. And we're going to see the theme of today is impact. And you'll see why, because we're going to be starting this shiur not just about Tanya, but we first have to start with the very source, which is the Baal Shem Tov, the father of Chassidus. Before we begin, I want to say a huge happy birthday to Nechama Lane. Thank you so much for sponsoring. She has attended probably every class of our last Tanya shiur and is a beloved member here, so thank you. And it's so exciting. There are some people who come because, you know, they could fill their day with Torah, and why not? Nechama takes off time, off of her business, off of work, and tries to bring other people as well to learn Chassidus, and I think that's truly inspiring, so thank you. And a happy birthday. It should be a year filled with mazel and goodness, revealed good in every way. Yeah, it's in your zchus that this is happening. So let's begin. Before we start delving into the Tanya, before we even jump into Perek Aleph, because that's too much of a jump, too much of a risk, we want to first talk about what is this class about? So let's have a brief introduction to Chassidus in general and a little bit see who laid the brickwork, the foundation down for the Alter Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, to write this incredible book. And then through exploring a little bit of the Baal Shem Tov, we'll be able to understand how it happens that the world is actually ready for someone like the Alter Rebbe and a book like the Tanya. Okay? So let's start with Chayel, 1698. This is when this precious neshama, the Baal Shem Tov's neshama, descended into this world. Now, there's a few really important stories to talk about when we speak about the Baal Shem Tov. There are books and books in English about the Baal Shem Tov, incredible books. Now, I know that there's common lore that every Baal Shem Tov story you hear, there's like another 10 stories that maybe never did happen. But there are some books that are very much verified and true, and you should look at those and explore the life of the Baal Shem Tov. It is literally a book of miracles, and it warms the heart, and it also helps you understand the generation that the Baal Shem Tov landed in. What were people going through at that time? So just to give you a little bit of background, right? We're talking about a time period, okay, so the late 1600s, where people were still living in abject poverty, right? We're talking about peasantry. And most Jews, unfortunately, were not wealthy at all. We're not able to be landowners. So where most Yidden lived, the shtetl life or shtetl concept that we know of, it's not like you see in necessarily Fiddler of the Roof. There was actually a different story earlier on, which was where the Baal Shem Tov was, which was, imagine, you have, it's different than a California climate where there's just great expanses of forest. And people used to think that the forest just go on forever because it just didn't seem to end. And then within like pockets of those forests, there were cities. Now those cities were nervous about security. So what would happen was there was a person or a wealthy person in that city who built himself a palace, a castle, and fortified his home. Now he had the luxury of fortification. Not everyone did. So the way that he built his home was with stone walls. And another, thing that they did was they created moats around the city or around the castle. And everybody kind of like gathered around that area for protection, not necessarily with that lord or king or prince actually help the people who lived on his lands. But the idea, the belief was maybe if I worked for him, maybe if I lived nearby him, maybe I would fall under his protection. So what's interesting and why this has to do with the Baal Shem Tov is that the Baal Shem Tov was actually from a place called Tlusk, but he also used to sign his name as Yisrael from, and he called it Akub. And the question is like, what's this Akub? Akub, what is that? He was from Tlusk. Is it a different name of the city? So no, what it actually means is a moat. Okay, so the people were so destitute, they actually built homes, like little shanties, inside the moat. And that offered some protection from nature, from storms, from people. And they literally didn't have much to build a home. So the Baal Shem Tov was literally born in one of these holes in the ground. Okay, so he was humbly signing his name from where his roots were, which were literally from the ground. Now, let's go even further back into the Baal Shem Tov's history before he was even born. Where is the Baal Shem Tov's neshama from? So this is fascinating. The Baal Shem Tov, when he was establishing himself later on, you know, when he was 36, as the Baal Shem Tov, he wrote a letter to his brother-in-law, whose name was Rav Gershon Kitever. And they, at first, Rav Gershon was a little hesitant. Nobody really knew who the Baal Shem Tov was. There was a lot of secrecy around the Baal Shem Tov. But once he accepted him, they became very dear friends. And in a letter from the Baal Shem Tov to Rav Gershon, he outlines where his neshama came from. Where did I land from? Who am I? And he describes a yid from the holy city of, not Tveria, Tzfas. The holy city of Tzfas. Who is this yid? A very simple yid. He lived according to Yiddishkeit, Torah and Mitzvahs. Very quiet, kept to himself. Nobody knew about this yid. One day, there's a knock at the door. Who's at the door? The man comes in. He says, I want to introduce myself. My name is Eliyahu Navi, and I'm here. I want to find out what you did on the day of your bar mitzvah. There was something that you did, some great, incredible act that the whole based in Shalmaila, everyone up above is talking about it still. And we need to know. Tell us. If you tell me, I'll teach you all the intellectual property of the entire world. You'll know everything. You'll know how everything about Torah, but you'll also know all the sciences. You'll know the language of the animals. I'll teach you it all. And the man thought for just a moment and said, you know, what happened to me on the day of my bar mitzvah and what I did then was between me and Hashem, and I'm not willing to divulge that information. And Eliyahu Navi doesn't know what to do with himself. And he goes back to Beis Shalmaila, and everyone's in an uproar because if they were already talking about this incredible act that this person did, which we don't even know what it was that happened on the day of his bar mitzvah, now everyone's just like, wow, he's doing it for Hashem, the humility. So they all decide, Beis Shalmaila decides, Eliyahu Navi, you have to go back and teach him everything that you were promising to him without even finding out what he actually did. So Eliyahu Navi became this man's teacher, and he taught him everything there is to know, every part of Torah, the depths of Torah, all the thoughts of the world, the wisdom of the world, this man knew and had and owned, and it was his. Now, nothing really changed. The people of Tzfat didn't know who he was. The people of Tzfat didn't know that he was this incredible tzaddik living in their midst. And when he passes away, he's welcomed and celebrated as a tzaddik returning, that neshama returning back to Shemayim. But there's one little problem. The angels say, you know, it's amazing that he was such an incredible person, but where's the impact? What did he leave the world a different place? Did he share his knowledge with anyone? No. Nobody knew that this incredible tzaddik was living in their midst. He didn't change or do anything. And so it was decreed that this incredible neshama would come back onto earth, and not just come back onto earth and relive a life and let himself be known. But this incredible neshama was going to bring a new power, a new revelation of Torah into this world, so much so that this new revelation would carry the Yidden to a state of Mashiach, to a messianic state. That's what was promised. And this neshama was the neshama of the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov writes about this, about himself, to his brother-in-law. Now, his descent into this world was also not a normal descent. You could see it in the story that is told about his father, Reb Eliezer. Who is Reb Eliezer? And his wife, Sarah. Beautiful people, really special people, lived in abject poverty, but opened their home to anybody else. And you can imagine that the people that they're giving their crusts of bread to didn't even have that. But they opened up their home, and they were really well known as these loving, caring people who didn't have children of their own. At a very old age, Rabbi Eliezer was around 100 years old, and Sarah was 90, reminiscent of Avram and Sarah at that age. One Shabbos, they're davening in Shul, and a man walks into Shul. Okay, so just to help you understand the time period, there weren't people in those days who were like struggling with their Yiddishkeit. You were either from, and that means fully from, or you were an apostate. You were someone who denied Hashem. You were completely blacklisted, considered a guy, right? That was the two categories. There was no like mixing of the two. You're from or you're not. And if you're not, you're not, right? So this man walks in on Shabbos, which means he clearly walked from out of town. Nobody knew him. And he walked beyond the tchum. There's a halacha that you're not allowed to walk beyond, I think it's 2,000 amais, from one city to another city on Shabbos. And this man had clearly, apparently, walked from some other town into their town on Shabbos, which meant that he was being not Shemer Shabbos, right? He was breaking the Sabbath. This was terrible, right? He's not just doing it privately. He's doing it in a public way. He's showing up to Sholi as the chutzpah. So everybody is shunning him. They're not looking at him, giving him a lot of space, giving him dirty looks. Rabbi Eliezer sees what's happening, and he purposely approaches this man and takes him under his wing, energetically speaking to him in warm tones, davens with him next to him, says, please come to my house for the meal. And he just takes him under his wing. He walks home with him, like holding his hand, with his hand over his shoulder, like really takes him in. And all the other guests who are supposed to be eating at Rabbi Eliezer's house don't really know what to do with themselves. Should they condemn Rabbi Eliezer? Should they fight? Should they get upset? And that's how it went. The entire Shabbos, Rabbi Eliezer was just so kind and giving and loving to this man. At the end of Shabbos, the man says, could you come to this other room? I want to talk to you. And he reveals down to earth to test whether Rabbi Eliezer and Sarah are worthy parents for this neshama chadasha, this new soul that is going to now descend into this world. And Rabbi Eliezer passed the test by showing how much he cared about another yid and how much sensitivity and love he showed, he was able to show to another yid, which was a perfect candidate for this new neshama, for impact, right? For this neshama that's going to bring this powerful new energy, a powerful new revelation to Torah. So miraculously, at 90 years old, Sarah had this baby. Rabbi Eliezer has this baby at 100 years old. Absolute miracle. But the Baal Shem Tov continues to stun and astonish everyone with miracles. And again, I know this sounds crazy to say, but this is what's brought down, that by the time the Baal Shem Tov was 3 months old, he was walking and talking, which is obviously absolutely supernatural. There's no possible way for a human child to do that. Our brains are not even developed enough to be able to come out of a mother having been developed to be able to be strong enough to talk and walk, right? That brain development happens afterwards. So the Baal Shem Tov was a supernatural human being, and he was well beyond norm. But he grew up in this enclave, right? In this very safe space of his parents' home, and the love and the care and the true Taira spirit that his parents exemplified. Unfortunately, by the time he was 3 to 5, we don't know whether he was 3, 4, or 5, at a very young age, Rabbi Eliezer was close to death. And his mother brings the Baal Shem Tov to his father's deathbed to hear what his father has to share. Just a moment, I forgot to say that when this baby was born, they named him Yisrael. Why would they name him Yisrael? The Friedrich Rebbe explains that, what's Yisrael? Yisrael is the name of the entire Jewish people, right? We are called Yisrael. And the significance of that was that at the time, the Jewish people, as he describes, was in a state of faint. When someone has fainted, when someone is in a deep sleep, or someone's unconscious, there's different ways of trying to wake them up. You could, you know, shake them. Or what we also sometimes do, I don't know if I did this morning with my child, not even knowing that we're going to talk about this today, but you call the name, because calling the name calls upon the essence. It wakes them up, not just the external kind of waking up. The Baal Shem Tov was supposed to be both. He was supposed to be like a shaking, like shake up the Jewish people, get them out of their faint, their state fainthood. And also his name itself was supposed to exemplify, this is who you are. Your essence is Yisrael. Wake up. We need you to come back here. You're falling into a state of faint where you're not actively fully serving Hashem. So Yisrael was supposed to be this experience, and he exemplified this person who's going to bring a totally new Derech Avaida to Am Yisrael. And he was supposed to be a leader of Am Yisrael and wake them all up. So at a very young age, let's say he was 3, he was called to his father's bedside, and his father was dying, and his father left him with a tzava, with his will and testament. He said, I want you, my son, to remember 2 things. 2 very important things. And the Baal Shem Tov never forgot these 2 things. The first is only fear Hashem. Do not fear anything else. Only be afraid of Hashem. Have awe and fear for God. And the other thing is to love every single Jew. Literally, no matter who. And these 2 concepts made such an indelible mark on Yisrael at such a young age, they became his way of functioning. This is all he knew, all he thought of. And in ways, the Friedrich Rebbe explains in a sicha that these 2, if you really like quantify them, they actually are the fundamentals, the sources for the rest of Hasidus. What is the concept of do not fear anyone besides for Hashem? It's the concept of Achtas Hashem, right? If I have a fear of, I don't know, let's say my boss is going to fire me, right? Then I am afraid of my boss and I'm not afraid of Hashem. That concept of seeing power elsewhere in otherness besides for God is the opposite of Achtas Hashem. Achtas Hashem is seeing Hashem as the one and only source of power. And Chassidus talks about this at length, talking about the concept of Achdus Hashem. And you'll see even in Tanya later on, we spend chapters and chapters talking about Shema Yisrael. And what does Shema Yisrael mean? That Hashem is Elokeinu and they're one. Hashem, right? Hashem is one. So that's one. And the next part, which is that you should love every single Jew, no matter what, no matter who, that's also a huge precept in Chassidus, in the Chassidic brotherhood, in our whole approach to Yiddishkeit. It's loving the other person, seeing their neshama, and seeing our own inherent greatness, seeing that we have a neshama, and how powerful it is that our neshama is our deep connection to the Eibishter. So all of Chassidus, if you wanted to really limit it or like, you know, squeeze it down to 2 phrases, you'll find that those 2 phrases are the phrases that Rabbi Eliezer left with his son Yisrael on his deathbed. Do not fear anyone and love every single Jew. And the Baal Shem Tov truly carried that, as you can see, as the rest of his life progressed. Unfortunately, after he finished saying, so now he's left at either 4 years old or whatever, 7, a very young age as an orphan. And in those times, when we're talking about people who are living in complete poverty, no one's adopting another child, right? So they had some sort of orphanage set up, which was basically a roof over your head. And they made sure that there was some clothes there, and maybe they sent some food. But there was no one, you know, tucking you in at night and asking after your welfare. You just were expected to go to the small school and attend school and then go home and basically live at large. And the Baal Shem Tov really had a very hard time. Had a very hard time living with people, with other people besides for his parents. His parents were sincere, God-fearing Yidden, and he couldn't relate to like these people who speak Lashon Hara, who say not nice things about each other, who get caught up in the world. And so more and more, the Baal Shem Tov actually started spending a lot more time in the forests outside of the actual townlet. And so he would disappear for days on end and just be living in the forest. And he was completely unafraid. You can imagine the first time that he disappears, you know, everyone sounding the alarm, and he comes back completely calm 3 days later. And they're just shocked. What happened to you? Are you okay? Are you traumatized? And he was like, no, I ate some berries. I was fine. Everything's okay. It was easier for him to be in nature and to be amongst Hashem's creations than to be amongst people and to be involved with the kids of the town and for the people of the town. And so he actually grew a name of being kind of strange, or like not everything being okay mentally upstairs, because he was very different from everyone around town. And so the Baal Shem Tov lived this experience of what his parents told him, his father told him, the first one being not being afraid. He would meet all sorts of wild animals. There was an account of him meeting a wolf in the middle of the forest, and he was with a kid, actually. They were hiking together. And is everything okay? They're like, there's a wolf. And he said, oh, why are we afraid? You know, like literally, totally no fear whatsoever, because at a very young age, heard what his father said, and just with absolute sincerity, inculcated into his experience. Nothing is to be seen as frightening except for Hashem. And I don't go through this whole entire story. What is important to note is that the Baal Shem Tov knew that, it's a funny word to bring to here, but he knew that there was a destiny here, right? He was so clear on the fact that his neshama was brought down into this world to make up for that, a huge to fulfill in this world. And that mission was to bring another power into this world, a great, strong power that would reveal a new avaita, a new path in Torah. Not that it's new that he was inventing things in Torah, but a new avaita in Torah, just like so many of his predecessors, right? If we look at other tzaddikim throughout the ages, look at Hillel, look at Shammai, look at the Rashbi, look at Rashi, look at Rambam. These people had a destiny. They had something to give to the people. And it wasn't supposed to just impact their generation. It was supposed to impact all of posterity, all of the Jewish nation. And the Baal Shem Tov knew that he was in that line. He knew that he had something here that he was given as a gift, and it was not about him or his greatness. It was about making sure that it was brought to the world for posterity, which meant that he had to have a long game in mind. It wasn't just, let me think about how to wake up my village or influence the people in my surroundings. He had to have a much broader context for what his mission was, right? Which is why, you know, you have that famous, we even probably have one here, that famous portrait of the Baal Shem Tov in the wagon flying through the sky. So many stories of the Baal Shem Tov traveling, nonstop traveling, trying to influence, impact so many, besides for just his small world. So there's a lot of different ways that he did that. There was a methodology to the way that he was making sure that the power of Hasidus spread, but was also taking root in the world. Okay? A few of the different things that he was doing to make sure that it was rooted was he had different types of followers. So as we know, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more next week when we talk about more about Chassidus, but the Baal Shem Tov's approach was very different than the people of his generation. People of his generation only had respect for Talmidei Chachamim. It was all about being learned. And if you were learned, then you were, there was a hierarchy. If you were learned, you were respected. If you were learned, you got an aliyah. If you were learned, you deserved more, obviously. And the people who were simple or sincere, or we call them sincere, the Baal Shem Tov called them sincere, but the simple folk were not considered special in the least. The Baal Shem Tov turns that around completely, took a completely different perspective on it, and champions the underdog, champions the simple folk. And we'll talk about that a little bit more next time, but the points that I'm trying to bring here is that he had almost like two different chassidim. He had the simple folk that flocked to him to hear his encouraging words, to hear his love, to experience his inspiration. And the way he interacted with them was very different. Okay, so he had two. He had these, let's say, like 60 chassidim who were Torah scholars, really holy people, who he gathered around him and he taught them Chassidus, like the Chassidus that we're going to learn in this class, where he taught them words, he taught them stories, he taught them Torah, but that only Torah that they would really truly comprehend and get and understand the depth of. And then there were the simple folk who he interacted with them in a very different way. He gave them shirayim. He gave them pieces of cake. He gave them inspiration. He gave them stories. He interacted with them and gave them brachais. And it was like, it was, his court was one of simple miracles happening all the time. There's a famous story of, and I think I even shared this with you a few weeks ago, but there's a famous story of the Baal Shem Tov traveling and came upon a shul, and he wanted to come into the shul, and a chassidim, knowing that the Baal Shem Tov was going to come to the shul, wanted to get more light. Like, let's light up the shul more, because the Baal Shem Tov loved light, not just because the analogy of how light brings a little bit of light, dispels a lot of darkness. It was like a mindset for him. Let's bring light to this world. That's literally who he was. So he walks into the shul, and he right away sees there's not enough light. He says, let's bring more candles. And the chassidim, anticipating this, had said, you know, we tried. We actually gathered all the people of the town trying to get more candles, but there just aren't enough. There's like a shortage. They're making more. And it's just interesting to think about, like, thank God we have electricity, you know. In those days, they just didn't. Imagine the winter, 4 o'clock, it's dark. And they want to sit and learn. They want to daven. There needs to be light. And the Baal Shem Tov said, okay, that's not a problem. Just gather the icicles from around the awnings of the shul and bring them in and we'll light those. And that's what they did. The chassidim gathered all of the icicles, brought them in, put them in the candle holders, and the Baal Shem Tov lit them. Miracles were a daily occurrence in the presence of the Baal Shem Tov. Honestly, when I hear that story, to me, the miracle is the chassidim who believed in the power of a nes and believed that if the Baal Shem Tov said, so that's what I'm going to do. I'll just go and gather the icicles, right? But the true power of the Baal Shem Tov and what he was trying to bring to this generation that was in a state of faint was, you believe in power being fire attached to a candle, and the way that the fire is going to happen is because there's a wick there and because there's wax, and that's what's going to make fire happen. No, Hashem is what makes power happen. Hashem is the only power. Hashem, who makes fire light, can make an icicle a light as well. It's an equal miracle to the Baal Shem Tov's eyes. And this was symbolic of what the Baal Shem Tov was trying to bring Hashem back to these people who had lost. They had lost hope. They had lost consciousness. They didn't know what they were doing any longer. The simple folk and the learned, for different reasons. And so, again, back to what we were doing, looking at how the Baal Shem Tov was building roots and spreading the idea of Chassidus, the planting the roots was with his 60 Chassidim, with those strong Chassidim who were understanding the new Derech Avodah he was giving over to them. The spreading of the light and the welcoming of the simple folk was, there's a new way. Come, come and see, come and hear. Listen to the Nisim, listen to the stories. Wake up. And part of making sure that Hasidus was going to stay beyond the Baal Shem Tov's lifetime was literally creating a new framework for Yiddin. And one of the new ways, things that hadn't been around was a Rebbe Chassid relationship. And that doesn't sound novel to us today because it's something that like we understand and see and we've lived with for the past 250 years. But what the Baal Shem Tov brought was a totally different dynamic where a Rebbe is someone that you come to for inspiration. He gives you a path in Avaida, and you don't just come to him once. You keep on coming back. You want to replenish your chayas, your feeling for your relationship with the Eibishter. You want to dip into this new experience of this Rebbe who lives an entirely different experience of godliness. And I need to kind of like wet my experience with his light and his love for God and then go back to my dismal, awful life, but infused with a warmth and excitement for my relationship with the Eibishter. And so what started happening is the Baal Shem Tov not just traveled, but he also had people flocking to him, not just to live by him, but to travel to him and then go back to their homes and then to travel to him and come back to their homes. There was like this almost like moth-like experience where they were just so attracted to the light that the Baal Shem Tov wanted to bring. And it was an important thing to plant into the dynamic, into the framework of Jewish lifestyle. It wasn't a part of our Jewish lifestyle to have a Rebbe, someone that you travel to, someone that inspires you, someone that you take a message from what he says to you and you live with it for years until the next time you come back. That change was a huge facilitator to enable that Hasidus would continue. It was important to the continuity of Hasidus because we needed this concept of a chassid needs to be attached to a Rebbe. He needs to be connected to someone beyond him. It wasn't a belief of the time. The Talmidei Chachamim of the time felt, I'm holy, I'm perfect, I'm good the way I am. I learned Torah all day. It's great. No one's holier than me. And that was sourced in ego. That was sourced in self-righteousness. And it was not transformational for them at their core, at what needed real transformation. And so part of this experience of a Rebbe Chassid was this also development of humility, of I need to make space for a Rebbe in my life. And if I have this passion to bring more of this inspiration into my life, I'll also be able to be less egotistical. See greatness for what it is and push myself aside a little bit more. And then by so doing, maybe I'll be able to also make more space for Hashem in my life. Maybe this incredible person will help me connect to God a little bit more and make him, all of his greatness, more real to me. So there were small steps that the Baal Shem Tov was taking in order to make sure that the continuity of Chassidus, this great power that was given to him, would actually stay. One of the other steps that the Baal Shem Tov took was knowing that this is going to be beyond him. So starting this Rebbe Chassid relationship also meant that there was a beginning of, I'm not going to say a dynasty because it wasn't quite a dynasty, but this start of this dynamic meant that there would have to be a Rebbe after him, right? Again, this is a novel idea. And there was going to be someone to give over his life's work to so that this person would continue to give over Chassidus to the people, to the masses. Now, the Baal Shem Tov was very attuned to different neshamas and knew when the Alter Rebbe's neshama was released into this world. He knew that the Alter Rebbe's neshama was the neshama chadasha, which means it's a brand new soul, not like the Baal Shem Tov with a mission, it had a mission, but it was a new neshama. And this neshama chadasha, he knew, was not supposed to be his chassid. He knew that the Alter Rebbe was supposed to be a third generation, not a second generation from him. And took pains, and the Alter Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov even told the Magid, who was the one who came after him, told him I had Mesiras Nefesh to make sure that I would not be known to the Alter Rebbe, because if the Alter Rebbe knew me or knew about me, he would attach himself to me. And there had to be Rav Dave Bar in between, the Magen Avraham Rich between. But the Baal Shem Tov gave very specific instructions to the Magid of what to do when the Alter Rebbe would come to him. He said, I know that the Alter Rebbe is going to come to you. You may have to wait 5 years, which indeed it was, until he comes to you. Do not seek him out. He will come to you. And when he does, you will let him know what his destiny is, what he is supposed to be doing. What was that message? The message was to make Chassidus pnimius for Am Yisrael, to make it practical, to make it real, to make it accessible for all of Klal Yisrael. What's interesting is that if you actually look at the Chassidus of the Baal Shem Tov's Chassidus is like little points, like little lines. The Baal Shem Tov didn't write down his own Chassidus. It was actually his Chassidim who wrote it down. And it's almost like, imagine an idea, but it's not like a fleshed out idea. It's just a, I don't know, I want to build a home. But it's not all the details of what that home was going to look like. What kind of floors, what kind of marble, what is the kitchen, what's the layout. It was just that one point of an idea. That was the Baal Shem Tov Chassidus. Hard to really comprehend the depth of what the Baal Shem Tov was bringing. The Magid brought a lot of explanation to the Baal Shem Tov's ideas, but it was oversimplified and not as practical. The Alter Rebbe took that Chassidus and it was deep and it was practical. And that was what the mission for the Alter Rebbe was. And we're going to go into next week exactly how he goes about doing this. But just to conclude with one of these stories, an interesting story, is that the Alter Rebbe was born to Chassidim. Okay, so his family was Chassidish, but he didn't know who the Baal Shem Tov was. Okay, so his family was into Chassidus. They were into the concepts behind it, but he never actually met the Baal Shem Tov, except on the day of his upsharn, where it's described this red-bearded, this gingy older man came to the Alter Rebbe's upsharn. And the Alter Rebbe, even at the age of 3, was so taken with this man who cut his hair, and he kept on asking, who is he? Who is he? Who's this man? He recognized everybody else. He didn't know who this man was. And the Baal Shem Tov had warned everybody, don't tell them who I am. I don't want to be known to him. But for some reason, it was important that the Baal Shem Tov actually met him, at least in person, and performed the upsharn. He was at his upsharn. So they kept on trying to evade and say, oh, he's just a person. He's a man. He just came. And the Alter Rebbe would not stop asking, who is this man? Who is this man? Until finally, his grandmother said, he's a Zayda. He's a Zayda. He's one of the Zaydas, grandfather. After that, the Baal Shem Tov, the Alter Rebbe stopped asking. At 3 years old, understood. And later on in life, when the Alter Rebbe actually became connected to the Magen Mizrich, he saw himself as the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. He truly heard those words as, he is my Zayda, and he called the Baal Shem Tov my spiritual grandfather. He truly saw himself as third generation, the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. He understood who he was meant to be and who he was. Okay, I want to go deeper into it, so we'll get to it later, but just so you know, when the Alter Rebbe came to the Magen Mizrich, the Magen Mizrich was very selective about who he allowed himself to be surrounded by, his Chassidim. Different than the Baal Shem Tov, the Magid was not traveling around everywhere like the Baal Shem Tov. He attracted a lot of people, but he also kept his Chassidim close, was very exclusive. And it was so interesting to everybody to see when the Alter Rebbe shows up at the Magid's doorstep as a young man. I think he was 17 or 19 years old, very young. He is immediately welcomed into like the inner chambers of the Magid. And it was clear that this was someone very special and someone that the Magid knew was going to be very special. Most of the other Chassidim were Elter Yidden. We're talking about like older Chassidim who have worked hard to get to be in that inner circle amongst the Maggid. And the Alter Rebbe just shows up and is immediately welcomed into the inner chamber and is told what his destiny is. So it was very clear that there was a favoring of the Alter Rebbe. With that, I wanna pause and just say, if I say it correctly, the Mayan Yisrael was started as like the Baal Shem Tov, what? Mayan Yisrael, right? So, right. Right, which is so beautiful. So it's very important that we lay the groundwork, understand what made it possible for the Alter Rebbe to do what he did. And we'll see as we even get into the Alter Rebbe's life, the trials and tribulations that he went through. It's interesting because one of the first things that the Alter Rebbe says to the Maggid is, and he's saying this completely humbly, he's not trying to say this in an egotistical way. He said, you know, I never had to work hard for anything in my life. Like, it sounds a little bit funny, but what he's trying to say is he was never challenged intellectually. And the Alter Rebbe, by the time he got to the Maggid, not just did he know Kula Terakula and had delved into Kabbalah, but he also knew the sciences. There's many stories of the Alter Rebbe about like solving math problems, deeply respected by non-Jewish scholars. And he didn't struggle with any of it. Meaning, obviously, someone taught him Aleph Beis, but after that, he would spend like a week or two with a teacher and move on because he outgrew everybody. So when he came to the Maggid, he was saying, I need someone to challenge me. And the Maggid, having heard what the Baal Shem Tov said, I should be giving over to you, the Alter Rebbe, he said, unfortunately, I have to tell you that you are going to be very challenged from here on in. And you see that the Alter Rebbe has many challenges beset him in his dissemination of Hasidus. And from as soon as he takes on the mantle of being Rebbe, it's extremely challenging, but the Alter Rebbe holds his ground and is able to work very hard to make sure that he does what he's supposed to do, this mission of making Hasidus pnimius, practical, pragmatic, and a part of what the Jewish nation really needed to uplift and wake up the Yidden out of a state of fainthood. So I'm looking forward to delving a little bit more into the Alter Rebbe's life and how he did that. And God willing, after that, we'll start with Perek Aleph of Tanya. I want to say that if you've been to this class before, the class is modeled after Rabbi Paltiel's lectures on Tanya. But since we're starting Tanya for Daily Living 2.0, I'm going to be bringing in like some other teachers as well, not just Rabbi Paltiel. There are other incredible teachers, Dvari Nisbaum. There's also Sharna Ginsburg, and many more. And I'm hopefully going to be bringing in their perspective or their way of teaching it as well. So it'll be slightly different, but we're still looking at the same content, the Alter Rebbe's Tanya. So I'm really excited. Thank you all for being here. So next week we're taking a break. We want everyone to know that we're starting a new share of Tanya, Perek Aleph. It's very exciting. Lots of people want to learn Tanya. Tell your friends, bring them. It's hard for people to start in the middle. So as soon as they hear that we're starting with Perek Aleph, it's as one time mentioned to you that she wants to learn Tanya but doesn't want to start in the middle, let her come, see if it's for her. And hopefully we'll have a new crowd to teach Tanya. You too. That's what we'll be very, very happy.